The whole point of the Buddha's teaching is come to the realization that life's perfect, that it's absolutely a seamless perfection. There's absolutely nothing wrong at all. Life is full of mystery, full of magic and wonder. It's a fluid, dynamic experience. And it's truly marvellous and truly wonderful. But for most people, they seem to miss it somehow. They seem to not notice how extraordinary it is to be alive and for this living experience to actually happen. It is a marvellous life. And the Buddha's teaching is designed to bring us to that realization, to come to understand truly that life is really just quite marvelous. People tend to misperceive it. And as a consequence, are perpetually dissatisfied. Life's never good enough. And there's always this inherent craving for life to be different. That somehow, if I do this, if I do that, that somehow I'll make life perfect. I'll make it what I want it to be. All that arises from a misperception. It arises from an assumption that the appearance of things is how things really are. The appearance of things is that life has these solid, separate entities that we can own and control. Whereas the reality is that life is a fluid, flowing, dynamic experience, and there are no hard edges, no separate bits to it at all. So we assume life to have finite objects that we can own and control, and we seek to gain our happiness and our peace of mind through these things. But of course, life is fluid and dynamic. Things arise and pass away. That's their true nature. So we keep getting disappointed when life doesn't live up to our expectations. This craving, this always wanting life to be different, is what stops us from seeing reality. As I said in the opening, when we first arrived before the meditation, it's like all spiritual paths go nowhere. The reality that everyone seeks, what in Buddhism we call nirvana, is right here. You live it every moment. There's not a moment that you don't live it. It's the craving for life to be different, born of a misperception and a misunderstanding, that means that we're perpetually blind to the way things are. It's in that way that we take life for granted, that we don't see the true magic and mystery of what we have. We already have all the jewels. We don't need more. We don't need to find the jewels. We just need to uncover what's already here. So the Buddha's teaching is all about coming to understand what you already have, what's already here, what this experience that we're going through now, what it actually is, what it consists of, how it works. In order to do that, he designed a training, what he calls the Noble Eightfold Path, and it breaks down into three separate sections. There's a section on how to live a good life. There's a section on how to develop the mind. And there's a section on investigating and generating wisdom into the true nature of life. And one way I like to illustrate these three trainings is to start from the point that life is perfect as it is, and that we keep ignoring the way life is, and that's what the problem is. So what we need to do is to generate insight into this living experience to look deeply into it in order to find out and understand the way it really is. In order to do that, there has to be a certain flexibility and adaptability and skill in mind. You have to be able to focus the mind in an undistracted way in order to look at life. So that requires some time in learning skills in mental control. So that's why we have the training in mental development. In Pali we call it samadhi. Now, in order to have a focused, aware, lucid mind, you can't just live life any old way. You have to live by certain guidelines in order to maintain a relatively tranquil life and calm life so that you can meditate and learn how to become mindful and focus the mind. So we also have, in the Pali it's called sila, which is the ethical discipline. And so on a foundation of ethical discipline, we develop the mind so that it's capable of looking deep into the moment in order to understand. So at no point do we ever move out of this moment. We're always in this moment. One of the things that's following this path we come to understand is what's called the law of karma. We come to understand how it works through cultivating a good life, living a good life. One way we do it is by keeping precepts. Precepts are training guidelines that the Buddha laid down that anyone can follow, and if they do follow, they find out for themselves whether or not it leads to a reduction in suffering and an increase in happiness. For the record, the five are what are the five? if it doesn't bubble up in a moment, perhaps somebody could start off for me. Oh yes, to refrain from killing or harming living creatures, to refrain from taking that which is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from all forms of wrong speech, and to refrain from intoxicating drink and mind-altering drugs. Now the whole point of this path is that it is about direct experience. We can sit here from now until the end of time discussing tamma, discussing the merits of living a good life. But the real secret, and what makes this such a magical training, is that you find out directly for yourself whether the law of karma is something real. And one of the ways that we can do that is by keeping the precepts. Does keeping the precepts lead to greater understanding of the way life works? I had an incident many years ago, just after I think it was one of my first interviews. As you all know, when you first come along, you have an initial interview. And a lady came in, she was a very nice lady, lived relatively local, and we were very handy for her, being a Buddhist centre close to where she lived. We had a nice conversation, and then I pointed out that we weren't a vegetarian organisation, that if people come on retreat, we do ask that you just put aside any views regarding food and just accept what you're given to eat in keeping with the spirit of the teaching. And she wasn't very happy about that and kicked up a bit of a fuss, and it lent a slight atmosphere to the interview. So it wasn't quite going as one might hope. So we discussed it, but she wasn't very happy with that. But then we came on to keeping the first precept. And she said, "Oh no, if I see a spider, I have to kill it." Which, being one of my first interviews, was a bit discombobulating. Needless to say, it didn't quite happen, and she decided not to come along. And so there was a lot of confusion there, and unnecessarily. If we want to find out whether the law of karma works, we keep the precepts. One of the aspects of the Buddhist training is that we're not trying to save the world. The world is big enough and ugly enough to look after itself. But we are an integral part of life. In reality, there is no separation, and there isn't a close interconnection. Therefore, our actions do reverberate, and so the Buddhist emphasis is on personal responsibility. That it's our actions, the way we choose to live life, that is important and will reflect in the kind of results that we get. Holding fixed views about anything tends towards wanting to put the world to rights, wanting the world to be different than it is. So the emphasis is on personal restraint and taking responsibility for one's actions and letting the world be what it wants to be above and beyond that. And it is therefore for anyone to find out for themselves if keeping the precepts does lead to a reduction in suffering and an increase in happiness. Does it lead to a more sober, lucid awareness of life? Because you think if you take the first precept seriously and you choose not to kill or harm living creatures, that requires more mindfulness. It requires one to pay attention and take care. Another way we can cultivate a happy life for ourselves and generate this calm mind that can be developed. If we develop what in Buddhism we call the parami, which are the perfections, these are compassionate activities that we engage in for the benefit of all beings, out of a sense of wishing to reduce levels of suffering in the world. And again, we can discover for ourselves whether acting in these ways does lead to a reduction in suffering, does lead to the generation of beautiful states of mind. For instance, one that came to mind today was, I recently asked one of the meditators if they'd do a short talk at the beginning of the meditation. And my usual ploy to help encourage them to say yes is to mention that the Buddha maintained that expounding the Dhamma, expounding his teaching, leads to wisdom, leads to the arising of wisdom. So that if someone compassionately gives their understanding of the Buddha's teaching, then they can expect as a result to grow themselves in wisdom. Of course, you have to give it a try to find out whether it works. I speak for myself. I found that the results of not just following this way, but hanging about and helping other people along have been truly astounding. Really, really quite mysterious, the workings of karma and the results of karma. Even just keeping the precepts and developing a compassionate attitude can transform people's lives. What living an ethical life gives us is a guilty-free conscience. It leads to a healthy self-image, a happy disposition, a faith in life, faith that the laws of life work for us, not against us. And that means that when we sit down to meditate, or we decide to develop our mindfulness practice, we're already halfway there, because such is the power of our actions that they really do produce a peaceful, calm mind. But the next aspect then is developing the culture of the mind. We have to deal with those terrible, horrible hindrances. Our neurotic dispositions, overbearing, overweening, self-concern that gets in the way every time we try to... Well, not every time. It shouldn't be so gloomy. But let's face it, the hindrances do a lot to wreck our meditations. Hindrances are the very craving that stop us from being aware of the true nature of life. The hindrances are things like sensual desire, that addiction to sense pleasures, always trying to find more pleasure to somehow dampen down and get rid of that restlessness, only for that restlessness to come back and having to indulge the senses yet again in order to try and find some peace. Or ill will, that tendency of the mind to try and destroy anything that gets in our way and stops us from enjoying the peace and the quietude. Hindrances like sleep, trying to get away from our problems with drink and drugs and so forth. Or trying to find peace through getting rid of all our worries by worrying. If I keep on worrying, eventually I get to the end of my worries and then I'll be peaceful. See how it all works. And the doubts, of course. Sit down to meditate. Am I being really nutty? What am I doing this for? Is this going to work? All that kind of thing. What were we doing when we're trying there? We're trying to reassure ourselves. We want security and peace of mind and happiness. If I just think this through enough, then I'll find some peace of mind. So it's undoubtedly the case that there is a rite of passage that every meditator has to go through, which is learning to accept your quirky, neurotic nature. Everyone who comes to meditator has self-concern. It's nothing new. We all have to learn how to accept and then learn how to restrain the hindrances when they do arise. It is possible. It helps enormously to accept instruction, to have a good, open, working relationship with your teacher. Teachers there out of compassion to help, born of their own experience, they understand the joys that come with successful practice and really only want to help people along the route. So seeing a teacher regularly, getting a good working relationship is critical and very helpful. It is possible to overcome the hindrances, and every meditator knows when they do, the mind is quiet, is peaceful, is tranquil. The white noise of the self-concern has temporarily at least abated. There's a real sense that life is as it should be, and there's a genuine happiness there. The Buddha likened freedom from the hindrances as being like freedom from debt. You know, when you finally pay off the mortgage, such a nice feeling. Or loans in my case. But still a lovely feeling. Once you deal with the hindrances and you put the hindrances to one side, there is nothing to stop process of the development of insight. All it needs is a focusing of the attention towards the right objects. Now in Vipassana, insight meditation, the right objects are the transient nature of everything that we observe in meditation. For somebody who frees themselves from the hindrances, who's got a little bit of study under their belts, so that they know that once they're free from the hindrances, the idea is to look at transience, not just sit there. But they know that the idea is to look at transience. then you can't really hide from the fact that everything in our experience does arise and pass away. It really isn't so stunning as you think it perhaps might be when you actually start to see the arising and passing away of things. You see that it's always been like this. Things have always arisen and passed away. The analogy or the illustration that came up in my mind was, because I thought we'd talk a little bit about perception and how it's through understanding perception that you really start to see how fluid and unfixed life truly is. When the mind's calm and you're just resting in the moment and you're watching things arising and passing away, perhaps you hear some sounds. So sound arises, and along with it comes a perception. Perception is the label that we attach to experience of birdsong. I'm sure it's a frequent occurrence for everyone to hear birds singing when they're meditating. But a point comes when you're observing that the sounds last just the most fleeting moment before they're gone. And maybe it's a blackbird and their beautiful call. But there's a recognition that you can't grasp, you can't hold the sounds. It's almost like the sounds are like bubbles bursting on the surface of water or something, maybe water drops falling or something like that. They just splash, they're there for a moment and then they're gone. All these sounds just arising and passing away. And in contradistinction to that, you see the perception, bird singing in the garden, perhaps. Perhaps that perception arises as a picture in the mind, or perhaps that perception arises as a word picture, bird singing in the garden. And you reach this point where you recognise that the perception gives the impression of some solidity to the experience. It gives the impression that there's a garden and that there's a bird and that they're singing. And the very words that we use tend towards the sense of permanence, of long-lastingness. So a bird is something that extends through time. Yeah? And a garden is, it's the same garden as it's always here at Orkana. It's the Orkana garden. And yet the actual experience is very different, because we're seeing that actually the phenomena, the sound, is arising and passing away, and that a different aspect of mind, the perception, is giving it a kind of fixity that it doesn't actually inherently possess. I hope that makes sense, because I'm not saying it again. I will try though. But so what we get is a recognition that we conceptualise reality as a perfectly natural part of what the mind does. We conceptualise reality because we need to, otherwise we can't function, because otherwise we're just lost in this mass of undefined phenomena arising and passing away. So quite naturally and normally, what we start to recognise is that the mind conceptualises experience in order to make sense of it. Yeah? And the only problem is that we take the concepts absolutely seriously. So the concepts like bird, singing, garden are taken to be absolutely real. Whereas when you start to see the arising and passing away of phenomena and how fleeting it all is, and how perception is just that one aspect of the overall experience that just applies a label and a sense of solidity, you begin to recognise what the mistake is that everyone's been making, this misperception. That we take our thoughts seriously. We believe them to represent absolute truths, when in actual fact, they're just constructs, conceptual constructs, to make sense of this whirligig of life flowing all around us. And yes, what have I written here? We see the stories are all unreal. Now, when we do hindrances, when we do worry, when we do ill will, when we do sensual desire, we're, in our minds, we're creating these conceptual constructions. So, what that chap said at work yesterday, oh, how could he say that? That's a terrible thing to say. Or, I wonder if I've got a job in the morning. Oh, I hope I've got a job in the morning. Are all these mental constructs, and we take them so seriously. Now, we do need mental constructs to make sense of the world. The problem is that we take them absolutely seriously. The analogy I've used in the past is like, with experience, time and experience with the meditation, instead of interpreting everything through those mental constructs, it's rather the mental constructs come down here and we see life directly as it really is. But we know that we can still use the construction in order to make sense of life, but we're not tied to it. Yeah? And the Buddha said, I think he said, I use the terms, but I'm not confused by them. And that makes a tremendous difference to life, because as soon as you're not interpreting through that view structure, you're seeing life as it truly is. And the whole purpose of the meditation is to come to see life truly as it is. So the insight is developing the capacity to see clearly what's truly going on. And in the course of doing that, you take your thoughts less and less and less seriously. You're still going to think we're discursive animals. I mean, you're going to plan a dinner party, you've got to use discursive thinking. But it's like you use it as a tool rather than being a slave to your thoughts. And it's once that barrier comes down, once you're no longer interpreting and judging and comparing life according to your view structure, but you're just seeing it directly, that's when the liberating understanding arises. That's when you see how truly, what a true miracle, a marvellous mystery this living experience is. I think that's what I wanted to say. And just to tease you a little bit, because we do take it so for granted, this living experience. But I remember a few weeks ago we had a class, and I asked people in the class if they could remember their first day at school. Can you remember your first day at school? Or can you remember your wedding day? Or can you remember what you did first thing this morning? Whatever it is, a memory pops up. How did you do that? How do you do that? I mean, science will give us a conceptual framework and will give us some kind of way of, you know, of describing it. But how did you do it? What is a thought? I mean, you do enough of them. Can anyone describe to me what a thought is? What is consciousness? I mean, consciousness is here all the time. Well, not just it's arising and passing away, but life is consciousness. We're all conscious. Do you know what that is? Can you explain it? Could you explain this moment? Could anyone describe this moment to me? Anything you come up with is going to be so paltry in comparison to the utterly dynamic interweaving of consciousness and mind and body and everything that's going on in this moment How can we possibly describe it? Well, the indescribable is nibbana. The indescribable is enlightenment. It's not so much with enlightenment that everything is explained away. It's rather that you just get completely immersed in the mystery. You don't need to have it described to you. You don't need it to be explained. It's like you delight in the mystery and the wonder of it. And the way you got there was by observing clearly and closely the true nature of experience, cut away the misperception and the reliance on interpretations. And you did that by developing mental skills and living a good life. And that once you have discovered the way life truly is, and that magic and the mystery, the wonder is always, it's ever present, and you realize that it is truly infinite and eternal. It's not, life does not arise and pass away. It's the contents of life that rise and pass away, but life itself is eternal and infinite. And yeah, friends of mine recently asked me why I never really kind of did much, why I never really went away much or got up to much, and I couldn't really describe to them the fact that I could just be sitting quietly, you know, and just be completely and utterly serenely happy and peaceful. So I couldn't describe that to them. But even just walking around Bradford is enough. It's enough. It's just all the magic and the mystery that you could ever want is all around you all the time. It's just you've got to take off the blindfold.